Hello, I'm John Ingold.
And I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. So each episode of the podcast, we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book to a random article and we invite the author on to discuss their topic and the craft of interactive writing. So it's all about narrative design and how we write for games. This week, we're really excited to have Holly Nielsen. Welcome, Holly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. Could you start off by just telling listeners a little bit about your background, who you are, what is it you do for games?
As John said, I'm Holly. I'm a game writer, narrative designer, and historian. A fun trio of things that I'm sure we'll get into. So my background is I started years ago as a games critic and journalist, and then I fell into, as you do, academic history, and then fell into into writing for games from that, and then fell back into academic history, and then fell back into game writing. So a little bit all over the place, but they all sort of inform each other in some, well, at least I think in interesting ways. We'll let other people decide that, really.
So it's the classic journalist to academia to games pipeline that we've all seen so many times.
Yeah.
And do you want to name drop a couple of games that you've worked on in case people have encountered them?
Yeah, so I've done a bunch of kind of smaller games, kind of in collaboration with other academics, kind of wanting to get their research out there, helping them with that. And then I worked on Neurocracy, and I've done, trying to think, when will this come out? Amberspire, which is, when does this come out? It's coming out soon. I don't know. I can't put a date on it, just in case.
Okay, all right. Somewhere around the time.
And yes, those are probably the two that. And currently working on Thousand Hells, which is David Dunham's next game.
He's in the Kaleidoscope as well. Actually, we'll get him on at some point. That's awesome. So. Yeah, Neurocracy feels like a very relevant game to your topic in some ways. But before we talk about that, we should say the second question of the podcast, which is, could you please introduce your article and just briefly outline what is it that you said?
Yeah, so my article was Cite Your Sources, and I had to double check that because to make sure I was citing my own source correctly. But it's basically about in flavor text, but in other information in games, of the value of citing where the information comes from as a way of giving two layers of information to the player in a very handy, by only adding a few extra words, and also to give, it enriches the game world, I think, but also it gives a very valuable writing tool of plausible deniability of when you get something wrong or if you get something that's contrasting, because I think contrasting information is wonderful and brilliant because that's how information often works. But it also gives you an out where you say, well, no, this is from in-game. It's separating developer voice from game voice, because developer voice players will often think is infallible and it's almost like the word of God, you know, the developer said this, so this must be true. And instead placing it to back within the game, which means that it can be fallible, it can be wrong, it can be of context and everything else.
One thing I appreciated about this article, and I should apologize, by the way, to listeners, I sound like I have a frog in my throat. I've inevitably, just before this podcast, lost my voice, but one thing that I think is quite interesting about this article is you've written it knowing that the default way that so many of us want to write these things is in that omniscient developer voice. And we might not even think about it, actually. We'd write a bunch of entries and we'd say, well, this is how it is, without always thinking about how that's received. And in fact, it could even be easier to do it this way, right? This is part of the point you're making. So I just wonder how far you think we could push this, or whether you've seen interesting examples of this done effectively in games that you played or that you've seen. Anything that comes to mind?
I mean, can I be really shameless and say Neurocracy? Is that terrible?
Yeah, please. tell us about how it works in there. That sounds...
So Neurocracy, I was one of many writers on it, you know, so I was brought on by director. It's not my, you know, it wasn't my creation. I was brought on to do something with it. But I've decided, yeah, I'll talk about Neurocracy, and it's the hardest game to actually describe and talk about as I keep learning. It's a ARG, alternate reality game, that's a near future fictional Wikipedia. And it was updated every week, and the players were solving it. There's kind of a murder at the center of it, but outside of that, there's all these other branching things, different writers updating different, you know, Wikipedia pages and so on and so forth. And it was Johannes Truens, who's the director of Neuroxy, approached me specifically because of my academic background, because it turns out being in academia and telling a story through passive-aggressive tracked edits and citations and footnotes came really naturally. And, you know, and that was the fun of it. And actually, you know, it's very literal in the sense that it has footnotes. Like, it has citations like Wikipedia has. And being able to play with that and being able to say, okay, well, if I change this slight thing, that changes the tone of this thing entirely. Or what does this thing say about this? And if I'm citing this source, what does that say about the person who is editing this and thinking about the layers of information there? You know, it's not just one bit of information, boom, there you go. That's what the player needs to know. There's two or three different layers. And the distance that that gives, and also the kind of space it gives the player to interpret, I found really interesting. And it was something I've always thought about a lot, because one of my first, you know, great loves in games was Dragon Age Origins. You know, I played it. I was just the right age for it when it came out. You know, as a teenager, I had nothing else to do. So I would sit and I would, you know, I would literally write out the branching dialogue and save before things and write out before I knew that narrative design was a job. I was, you know, doing...
I love that.
But one of the things I love in that game is that it opens, and when I teach history and world building to game design students, I actually still open with the opening of Dragon Age Origins, which is probably very embarrassing and old-fashioned because it's, you know, pretty old game by this point. But it works really well because it opens with the words the Chantry tells us. And it starts with a canticle, you know, part of a hymn, and it cites the source of it. And just by saying that, it immediately tells you that everything you're hearing after this is a point of view. It tells you that there's a power dynamic of the information. It tells you that there's an overarching religious organization that controls this narrative. And so, yeah, it's just brilliant in that it's so economical with what it does, but immediately tells you so much. And it immediately means that this could all be wrong, because, you know, what follows is kind of, you know, oh, and they went to the room of the gods and blah, 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 fantasy nonsense. But yeah, I always thought that was just such a clever way of just setting something up. And yeah, I was always really inspired by that.
So I think that's really fascinating, because it's that idea of setting up a frame around the game, around the story that you're telling. And I can imagine that for a lot of game writers and designers, that idea of putting the game within a frame is kind of challenging, because we're always going on about immersion and getting the player immersed in the source. So is there a conflict there between creating that frame, that plausible deniability that you mentioned earlier, and burying the player in the world, or is there not a conflict there? Is that a false argument?
I mean, you know, people may disagree with me. I personally don't find much of a conflict, and I think potentially it comes from the historic, you know, my own historical background, because history itself is conflicting and confusing and built. It's a written, built thing that is constantly changing. You know, it's not just this tome of lore, of canon, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, five historians wrote in Oxford in the 1950s and we just stand around looking at it and go, yay, it's history. You know, it's this constantly changing thing. And so I think it feels much more authentic in how information works to have this framework, because what we know, how we know it, who knows what, who they heard it from, is much more of an authentic dynamic for information. I think, at least for me, you know, other people may disagree. And I think it definitely has its challenges, because all of a sudden you're having to balance different power dynamics and you're having to balance different things, and potentially you're holding a lot in your head. But I think, as I tried to say in the chapter, that it actually gives, you know, it gives you deniability if something does, you know, ideally conflict information has, it's done with intention. But let's be honest, that's not always the case. Especially
well, you
games.
Do layers of writing, right? Where and things change.
And so big, and they can pass different hands, and you have a different writer working on this bit and a different, you know, and they can be so complex and so many different fingerprints on this thing that being able to have that little bit of plausible deniability and say, well, you know, this was actually part of the world and therefore is a point of view and is part of that. And so it can be wrong, or it can be, you know, its own thing.
I love
how that's turning a bug into a feature.
Yes, exactly.
Of world building is just really, really great. But sorry, Sajid.
It's great because it's a type of bug that every single project that has any sort of narrative weight to it goes through. So it is a quite clever way of dealing with this that still enriches the world. You introduced the concept of just the production process, right? Of how helpful it can be to fit this into that. And it does make me think, basically every game I've ever worked on, I've wanted to introduce a deep set of lore because the world building is so fun to do, right? And and you always want to give it to the player. But inevitably, you know, it's not a book, it's a game. And usually, therefore, these are more optional features sometimes, or there are things you can find in the world and a player who's very interested can perhaps read them. There's a codex, something like this, right? However, often those become very, I suppose, very vulnerable to scope cuts as things go on, right? Have you found ways that these can still be part of the golden path, so to speak? Is it usually the case that these are optional features or optional elements of the game?
I mean, I've seen them used in ways that, so a game I'm working on at the moment, the actual game itself, the way that the narrative is shown, it doesn't lend itself to having things cited. It just doesn't work in that type of game. It doesn't work in the UI. However, they are doing a wonderful kind of guidebook, you know. Oh my God, what's the word? You know, used to get them in a game. You'd have a little...
The manual?
Manual, that's the word, yes. So you'd have a little manual, and they're doing a kind of something to go alongside it. And within that, we're using cited information, little bits of it. Like, it can literally be... And one of the things that... when I first started working on Amber Spire, Nick Tringali, who's the director, reached out to me asking what sources historians had used that weren't just written text, that weren't just books or letters or things like that. And when Nick messaged me saying that, I was in the middle of finishing my thesis. And so I was glad to think about literally anything else. I was desperate to just think about possibly anything that wasn't my own thesis. And so I wrote them a kind of... a document, just a little document, going through some sources that had been used, how they'd been used, how they could apply to games, and then potential problems with translating that. And so it's everything from tattoos, like body modifications that have been used, material culture, you know, how changing material culture, how does that translate, and things like that. And, you know, that's, you know, you may not see all that in the final game. It may just be in this manual, but actually that approach, then it shapes a lot of how we then ended up writing the game and the stories we told in the game, and refocusing from this big macro histories to the smaller micro, and how do those two things interact? Because these kind of, you know, material culture, or this, you know, the tattoos, body modifications, all these really interesting sources that historians have used to gain information, they are often done on a micro level. And so there's something, there's just something so lovely and meaty about that. And so, yeah, so in a game like that, it is not in that, you're not going to see me saying, you know, blah, 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 cited by so-and-so, because it doesn't fit in the game. It just doesn't work. Yeah, as I said, but it is in there in some senses. And it also just approached that idea, that framework, approached the stories we then told in the game, even if there's not a literal citation in the game itself.
I love that idea of moving away from world building as like a collection of like big facts and political structures, and this is the date in which the war happened, and that kind of database stuff, to something a bit more anthropological, like asking questions. I don't think when we're building games, we often think about things like, how do the normal people in this world write stuff down? How do they record their family relationships? How do they record their significant events? Like, I don't think I've ever seen a world building document that mentions whether people have wedding rings in this world or not, but surely every character should or shouldn't, and it tells you a huge about them. Do you find that taking this slightly more anthropological approach, like, does it double the workload? Does it triple the workload? Is it just like this whole other axis? Do directors say, sorry, we're just not even going to begin to think about this stuff? Or...
I mean, in the stuff that I've done and the stuff I've been brought on to, it's often because they want that angle, and it's because they want these, you know, they want this kind of
depth,
details and things like that. And often because these little details, often that's where the kind of the interesting stories lie. I think I'm also biased because as a historian, I do everyday history. The type of history I hated was like, and the king went over here and he did this thing. And aren't these big, important, you know, quote unquote, great men good and they do this. And then this era, I find that stuff painfully dull. I still do. I can't, you know, that's maybe sacrilegious to say. But what I find
but it's a list of facts, Holly. Oh. You've got to learn a list of facts. That's what history is.
It's just, it takes a long time to be able to escape that when you're studying history. But if you do, you're paid off. I'm much more interested in, okay, this big thing happened. How does this affect people? How does this affect everyday lives? Okay, there's this big temperature shift. Does that change how they build their buildings? Does it change how much time they spend indoors? What would that impact on family and all of that? And I think there's a potential issue there of just endlessly going down. You could chase those routes endlessly. You could chase those things for hours, or you know, days, weeks, years, and drive yourself mad because trying to build this thing. So I think a lot of it is about, well, what's important, what's actually going to be seen and shown, and you have to think, because, you know, sometimes when students or something will come to me with, oh, I've got my, you know, my world building document, and they'll be just like reams and reams and reams of this big, and then in the fourth era, the da 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 of something or other, and I'm like, that's great. Player does not care. Does not care. But what the player might see is they might see, I don't know, an emblem on a door that signifies part of this, and just having that, you know what I mean? There's all these like little things that the player will actually understand, they will see, and it will allude to something. But you don't have to, you know, you don't have to have like, you know, all this enormous stuff. You just have to think, what's important to me? What's important to the player? What are they actually going to see? And think about these things and think about the little details, because I think that's where, you know, authenticity is something that's thrown around a lot now at the moment. I think it's kind of it can be misunderstood, but I think having something, what I'm really interested in is games that, you know, even if they're doing something really weird, really out there, they also feel lived in. If they are lived in, if it is a world that is lived in.
Well, this point you've made of, well, overall, just thinking about this anthropologically or thinking about the material culture. I mean, I love this too, of course. I mean, one of my favorite things about worlds that feel deep, that sense of wonder, is just from comparing your day-to-day existence from what these characters or these people's lives might have been like, whether in real history or in a game. But it is funny because even games that aren't primarily about those things, I suppose it's quite common to be playing a game in a fictional setting where there has been some previous civilization or some previous structure that we are layered upon. I think just like people in geek culture just love this concept. And maybe it's because we've all spent too much time playing Dungeons and Dragons, right? But like it's so baked in that when there are games that are about those topics, like I think of Sable from a few years ago, it's so evident. It's almost like the world building is being used as briefings to the art department, as like how you want to display these things, where they want to come up, and which things are brought explicitly and which things are sort of kept in the background. It just seems, it seems like those things can arise in very unexpected places. Like I've never been to a studio where there hasn't been a much deeper understanding of the depth of the world than is presented to the player. There's no question in there, I suppose. Sorry, just to comment. Yeah.
I think it's good. I think it's interesting because something I come across in games quite a lot, because games love big catastrophic events. They love something that's gone wrong and there's a previous civilization. Maybe it's an ancient, maybe it's like an ancient kind of, you know, maybe it's alien, maybe it's something other. And it's interesting. And sometimes it's done really well. And sometimes there's this odd flattening that happens where it just means that there's the before and after. There's the before the event and then there's the thing that happens after. And that can be done really interesting and it can be done really well. But sometimes, it feels like a flattening of time and potential and geography. And you know, you may do that for many reasons. It may be deliberate and that's wonderful.
But that doesn't happen in real life, right? Real life is full of apocalypses, right? Like it happens all the time and there's always a layer or something else that comes in and shifts. It's never a hard cut, right?
And it's often the thing that I find occasionally missing from some world building stuff is how do people feel about this? How do people, you know, it's again, that's part of my historical background is looking at history of emotions and history of feelings and things like that. And so that was one of the big things when we were working on Amber Spire, is that there's, you know, the in Amber Spire, it's a city built, science fantasy city builder, and it's built on this kind of hollow constructed moon, and underneath is this vast mausoleum, and the idea is that as if buildings collapse, they break through and the mausoleum starts to appear. And it's based on the idea of the canals in Venice. And so, but when you build a game, you see the mausoleum peeking through and the decisions you've made and things like that. Really cool. The art's absolutely stunning. But I was trying to think, I was like, okay, well, how would people feel building a new city on something that is so precarious, so ever present? And I kind of, and I came back to Nick, and I, you know, one of these wonderful questions that comes up when you're trying to, yeah. And I said, does the mausoleum have like fish? And Nick was like, what? And I was like, well, I'm trying to think of how we, and I ended up settling, you know, I was thinking a lot, and I was like, well, actually, no, we live with precarity and we live with potential danger constantly. It's part of being human. And I thought of the sea a lot. You know, we live by the sea as this incredible, awe-inspiring, beautiful thing. It's also terrifying and destroying and eating away at our coastline and ever-present. We're battling it. We live with it. It's beautiful. It's scary. It's all these things at once. But also there's an aspect of we get something from the sea. We use it for travel. We use it, you know, we get fish from it. We get all of this stuff. And so I, and yeah, and so then Nick said, yes, there's this, you know, there is something, there's a reason why people would want to be down there beyond kind of more kind of religious, ritualistic reasons. And then that changes everything. That means, okay, that will change, you know, that changes how people feel about this. And it just, I like working on that stuff because it then, and then, you know, there's no point in the game where I'm writing down that people feel about the mausoleum in these different ways, but it impacted the events I wrote for it massively, you know, because then you're like, okay, well, the day-to-day people might feel this. Some people might be resistant to it. Some people might celebrate it, they, you know, all of this stuff. And so, yeah, it's finding, and I think that's, if you have these bigger issues, like you have the macro, you have this, you know, giant mausoleum, but how do you fit that with the micro? How do you fit that with people? How do you, especially in something like a city builder where it is, you know, you have people there, you have people living their everyday lives. And so, yeah, finding that, finding the thing, and that's, I think, a thing where you can, you know, stop yourself going insane, trying to think of every possible single detail that could, you know, what are they having for breakfast? And it's like, well, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. We're not talking about breakfast. But you have these bigger things, and those bigger things will trickle down. And yeah, that's where you find, I think, for me, at least personally, that's where a lot of kind of interesting storytelling happens.
Right. So in the gap between the experience of the people and the understanding that the people have of that experience, that's where you get stories about the past because they've got their different perspectives on it.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of people kind of go, well, it's unknown. And it's like, okay. let's unpack, you know, it's, let's unpack that a bit, because people, you know, people deal with gaps in very different ways.
And we, you know, they make, when people don't know stuff, they just make it up, don't they?
Yeah,
that's what we see in day to day.
They'll make it work.
Yeah. I really like what you said about the flattening of the world and history. It reminded me of Star Trek, right? Of Star Trek. Whenever they go to a planet in Star Trek, it's a whole planet, but it's only got one civilization on it only one period of time. It's like, and I remember my brother was a huge Star Trek fan, and he'd say, oh, it's just like going to another country. They've just borrowed that. And I was like, well, actually, if you go to another country, there's also history in other countries, like and multiple cultures and overlapping stuff. But I guess the counter argument, though, is that when you're dealing with a really new world, it just gets complicated really fast. Like, do we need to rein ourselves in a little bit when we're doing world building and this kind of construction of these multiple layers of history? Do we need to be careful that we don't just overwhelm people with this complexity? Like, we fall into rabbit holes as writers all the time, but like, do we need to avoid creating rabbit holes for our players?
I mean, it depends on the game, massively. It depends on, do you want them? Do you want to give them the space to fall down that if they so wish? Do you want to keep it? I think it massively depends on the project. And I think I've never been a, you know, quote unquote solo developer. I've worked on smaller projects on my own, but all the games I've worked on, I've worked with other people. And I think the working with other people and working with, you know, a director or an art director or something like that, I think that helps rein you in. Because ultimately it's the communicating of other people and really hashing out, okay, what's important here? but I think that's why, again, when I, you know, it's slightly different but similar is, you know, people will ask me about historical consultancy, you know, working in games that maybe have a historical setting or they have, you know, they want to bring historical themes and things like that. And, you know, my advice is always bring in the historian early. Bring them in early because the little bits of information they give will shape everything else. And by the time you've built the thing and you go back, they're not so much looking for consultancy as they're looking for a okay, looking for a thumbs up. And yet, okay, that's fine by me. You've got the historian tick of approval. And I think, yeah, having this stuff early on and seeing, letting it shape and letting it, you know, evolve and all of that. But I think at least for me, working with other people is what keeps you, you know, keeps you on track. And, you know, having a producer there, you know, tapping their watch and things like that, which, you know, it's not going to be true for everyone. They might not have that structure around them. But I think always keeping in mind of what is the player actually going to be seeing? What is the player actually going to be? What's important for you to get across? Is there, you know, and I think at least that for me, that's how I try and frame it. And sometimes, it, you know, there will be rabbit holes, but yeah.
I wonder if there's ways of taking this quite thorough world building you might do. I mean, we're coming here from this concept of facts have opinions and context, of course, right? So I wonder if it's fun for us to do, of course, as writers, to be like, let's imagine this faction or this perhaps this religious association, what have you, right? But I wonder how and when they can be incorporated into normal play, like whether quests can then be designed off of these things, or depending on the game, of course, right, what you're doing, or say in your city builder, whether you could adjust the architecture of some places if they were done from a different faction or from a different period in, you know, in history of that mausoleum. Like, is that hard to do? Is it hard to go from coming up with this world building and then seeding it into other elements of the game? Or do you often come at the end of that process where it's too late?
I mean, for Ambuspire, so the example with the mausoleum, I came in after the art was done, after the, you know, the world had already been built in many ways. You know, Nick had already come up with the factions, had come up with all of this. I think I came in and just really got into the details and got into the, that's, you know, Nick has been really sweet and said, you know, one of the things I brought was, you know, Nick had this big, you know, they had all the macro sorted out. And I came in and just kind of, I guess, found a little bit of grounding and found, and then from that, that definitely shaped the stories we told from it. And it also gives variety, because if something is, you know, there's only so often that a faction can have a crisis. There's only so often that, and it, you know, and all these endless things and everything, if everything's, you know, world ending or city ending or all of this, I don't know, personally, I actually, it's funny you brought up Star Trek, because I have a term that I always think of, which I call it the polystyrene cave. And the polystyrene cave is when there's a kind of a story being told and it's sci-fi or maybe fantasy, and I can picture the Star Trek polystyrene cave. And I can picture, and it is this when something's like, here is the one thing we're dealing with here. And here is the people with the slightly different costumes and they're going to represent this. And just thinking, yeah, and just try, and I try and always, and you know, that's wonderful and great. I'm a huge Star Trek fan, love it. You know, maybe people want to aim for that, which is also absolutely fine if that's your intention. But just kind of problematizing a little bit, just kind of finding and not seeing that as a way of like, oh, well, you've messed up my lore now. I'm saying, well, no, actually, that's a potential hook for a story or for a character or something.
The contradiction.
The contradiction is the thing in and of itself. And so, again, it's finding these what potentially are bugs and problems and going, well, actually, no, that's a potentially really interesting story. Or it could be represented by, you know, a kind of totemic character who takes on this, you know, they have to represent a lot more than what they are as an individual, or, you know, just a little thing, a note or something or other, and just finding, you know, seeing these contradictions and these problems as a possibility rather than, well, now, you know, now my big, you know, world lore document doesn't make any sense, where it's like, I think if it's that fragile, there's not room to play with it.
Yeah, I've always been inspired with world building by Doctor Who, the fandom of Doctor Who, right? When people are writing Doctor Who, which has obviously been gone on for about 60 years now or something, the individual writers just make up whatever they feel like.
Yeah, whatever they want.
Get away with at the time. And it largely doesn't make any coherent sense. But then there are dedicated people on the internet who spend a long time making it make sense and saying, oh, well, you see, the reason that this fits together is like this, this, and this. And obviously they know that they're triangulating a solution that doesn't really exist. But But you can almost always do it, is the thing. It's like no one has managed to write in 60 years a thing in Doctor Who that you cannot rationalize somehow. So I kind of lean into that quite a lot with world building, and quite often when deciding things, because I'm quite lazy about world building, that I'll just choose a couple of things that look interesting and create an interesting opposition to each other without necessarily actually solving the problem properly. So I guess the question part of this, and I know what my answer is, but I'm interested in your answer.
Oh, no.
As a historian.
Oh, no. Is there a right answer?
No. I don't think there is a right answer. But just like, as a historian, like the thing about history is, on the one hand, it's entirely told by unreliable narrators, kind of, as you said. But the other thing about history, we're fairly sure it actually happened. Like, we can't be 100% sure, but we're fairly sure that there was actually an exact chain of events that happened. I know, when you say this to historians, they go, well, you go, no, but come on. Like, something did actually happen, we think. But when you're world building, that requirement goes away. How important is it for there to be a fact basis to world building? And how, because if we're only thinking about what the player sees, how much, like, where do you stand on that balance between kind of making up things for the player to do and then solving how they fit together later, and building a world in Tolkien style, I suppose, and then walking through that world? Like, do you think it's project dependent? Do you think it's personality dependent? What do you think?
I mean, it project dependent. I mean, that's such a cop out answer, but it is. but it is really project dependent. And yeah, sorry, repeat the question. I got confused.
Basically, it's plotting versus pantsing, building.
Yeah.
Like, are you designing everything up front and then using that, or are you designing the experience first and then solving the world building as a consequence of what you came up with?
I mean,
especially
really,
for this question of coherence, right? Like, does it need to be coherent first?
Yeah.
Even if you never express that.
I mean, I don't have any strong opinions either way. I think both can work, depending on what you're wanting to do. There might be, I think some documents that I tend to really like, you know, there are very good reasons why you would have a world Bible, in the sense of, okay, we all know this thing. Okay, this thing happened, blah, blah, blah. Here are some reasons why people might think it's that way, but we're thinking of it as this thing. But then thinking, okay, well, what does the player know out of that? And I think that's something that's sometimes lost in documents, is like, okay, we know this. What does the player know? What are we telling the player? And because that's really easy to lose track of. I think either way can work depending on the story you want to tell. And I personally, again, I think probably because of my background, I really, actually this term comes from you, John, and I've stolen it completely because I love it. It was a talk you gave and you talked about like narrative Sudoku and the idea that there is a finished thing at the end and you're filling it in. And that can really work. Me personally, it doesn't hugely appeal to me, I think, because at the end of the day, there's still a finished thing. And I kind of go, that's not really what interests me in this thing. I'd rather, you know, because you might say, okay, well, this thing definitely happened, you know, this thing. But as you said, historians will, you know, unless there's, you know, there's obviously certain things. I'm a modern historian, so, you know, I have ample, you know, I'm not a classicist, I'm not an medievalist, so I have lots of sources to work with, so I can be a bit surer on some things. But it just very, very quickly, it becomes, you know, you could say, well, I don't know, a king is killed with so-and-so, was it murder? I don't know, was it manslaughter? I don't know, the idea, we know he died, but how did he die? You know, all of this stuff, it very quickly can become problematized. Problem? Is that a word?
Yeah,
it is now.
Okay, good. I'm starting to doubt everything I'm saying. In true fashion, nothing is.
Do
real.
We have a language?
Amazing.
Yeah, do we ever even developed have a language? I don't know anymore. I'm going full kind of post.
Does Holly Nielsen even truly exist?
I don't know.
We'll never know.
Does she have a past?
And I think if you want to truly drive yourself mad at these questions, read French postmodernist history, because that is truly like, you know, we are only like grains of soot in the thing, we cannot know anything and things like that. And I don't personally go that far. I don't personally, in terms of my own academic leanings, I don't go that far, because I'm a big, I come sources first, theory after, rather than theory first, sources after. And I think that's a big difference between a lot of academics. And so I like stuff. I like things. So it's nice sometimes to have a thing of like, okay, here are the points we want to hit. Here are the story beats we want to hit. Let's build from there. rather than, okay, I have a thing I want to get across. Let's make something work. I don't know. I think it's highly dependent on the project, but I'm kind of happy either way. But I also, I quite like working on something that already exists in some way, because, I mean, the parameters are always fun. It's always fun to go in somewhere, muck it up a little bit, and then rearrange it a little bit and make it work. And, you know,
I always think there's that interesting friction when you have an established world building and then you come up with a beat or a story and someone comes along and says, oh, no, you can't do that because I don't know, because that requires your character to walk in sunlight for 33 seconds and they can only walk in sunlight for 32 seconds because we established that earlier. And you go, well, can we just break this rule? And they say, no, our law is really important. And whereas my inclination in that kind of example, it's always to go, well, in this case, he can walk for 33 seconds. And doesn't that raise an interesting mystery, which will be solved by future writers? But like, and to treat world building as this kind of very malleable clay that we can kind of, we can attack the past and the present if we want to.
No, I agree. I actually think, like, sorry, please go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm kind of the opinion that world building should work for you rather than you working for your world building. I think if you feel shackled by this thing you've created, then maybe it's time to reevaluate your relationship to it. Because I think that's where you can get really stuck. And actually, this thing you're creating should serve you. You are not serving it.
I'm running a D&D game for a bunch of 10-year-olds who know much more about D&D lore than I do. So, every time we meet a dragon, I'm like, it's a gold dragon. They're like, no, gold dragons are good. And I'm like, what? And like, okay, it's a purple dragon. They're like, no, there's no such thing as a purple dragon. I'm just like, look, what color is this dragon? And they go, oh, it's a green one. You go, okay, fine, it's a green one. Yeah, exactly.
John, the fact that you do not realize that metallic dragons are good is very upsetting to me. Like, I feel like this is a thing that we need to correct very quickly.
The book is like this big. There is no way I'm reading that for the benefit of some 10-year-old. Anyway, carry on, please.
No, it's very good. I actually think, so I know that like some of this discussion may have seemed a little bit abstract, but actually I resonate with what you've just said, Holly, quite a bit. So I work for the Chinese Room these days, and we often have a desire in our titles to retain ambiguity in careful ways. And we're always having having this exact same debate all the time about the titles that we've done in the past, about the titles that we're trying to build, but which things we want to leave to the player's interpretation, but give hints to, which things we need to have an answer to internally as devs, just to be able to produce sections of content, and which areas are best left as answer a question, but open up a surprise of many other questions that come from there that could help completely recontextualize what you've done. Past games that we've done, Everybody's Gone to the Rapture or Still Wakes the Deep, we've very specifically not been clear about some of the things that we've done. So the sense of like consensus, whether you need to have even in game an established reality or whether it's more interesting to just have multiple different people disagreeing about an outcome, that's like real and live discussion that we have in narrative meetings all the time at work. So
I mean, it's always interesting. I'm an absolute sucker for an unreliable narrator. It's always, you know, if you have an episode where it's two people telling, you know, the story of the same thing and it's from different angles and it tells you something about their character and blah, blah, blah. And I always think that's interesting with games, particularly games where you're inhabiting a character. And it's like, okay, well, you're inhabiting a narrator, whether or not, you know, yes, you're seeing through their eyes, but that is, you know, everyone sees something different perspective, all this stuff. And so I know some people may find this kind of frustrating or a bit too kind of loose, but I'm a big fan of not having answers and maybe things not making sense. Because I think that's one thing, you know, it's interesting when I was first, you know, kind of doing some consulting work as a historian working on games. And I think a lot of people, and, you know, some historical, when it depends what you want from a historian when you bring them onto a game, but they think I'm going to come on and go, no, you don't get to do that. No, that's not right. That's not accurate, actually. Which is very boring. It's being a professional fun sponge, which is just not particular. And also, I'm not going to get into the whole thing of like, you know, accuracy and stuff like that, because it's the most boring conversation you can have when it comes to history and games, in that I think it's kind of nonsense. But what's far more interesting is making something realistically obscure, or making something realistically vague or contradictory, or making something, understanding where those like diverting paths may happen, why they happen, how do they show themselves. And so I think of it a lot as, you know, coming back to what I said earlier, is like information dynamics and power dynamics. And thinking, I think a lot about power dynamics of information, and that can even be from a sensory perspective of an individual. And for me, I think that's where you get the really interesting contradictory stuff. And so I know people may find that annoying of like, well, but there has to be a thing. No, there has to be. I like my things. I like my answers. But I'm a big fan of, okay, well, you might get an answer for this thing, which may then open up more questions. But, you know, that's life.
I love this idea that the stereotype of the world builder is someone who wants to know everything exactly, whereas the historian who lives in the real world would like everything to be an ambiguous, like a contradictory thing that can't make sense. It's almost like one of the attractions of world building is like life is really complicated and confusing, mm-hmm. and we'd like a version which we can detail in a spreadsheet and sort of tick off as we go. That's really kind of reassuring. I really resonate with what you said about the leaving, the Sudoku problem being that you end up with something complete. It's like when you finish it, it's no longer, it's solved, so you don't need to think about it anymore. Mm. Whereas if you leave people with a central contradiction, they can never stop thinking about it because they're always going to have this war going on between the two versions, which is a dirty trick. But then I sometimes wonder if as writers, we're always looking for good dirty tricks to pull in our audience.
Of course we are. Like the one corollary is you want that contradiction to have just been intentionally left. It might have arisen accidentally in the course of development, but ideally the thing that they're debating has been seeded a little bit by you. They're like, yes, this is a good juicy question for you to keep debating. Like,
you've just mucked it up and you've actually.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like in your article, Holly, I cannot help but be completely arrested by the fact that you have a character named Lester Uff that you have put everywhere. And I'm like, who is this Ibn Battuta in your world that is traveling from place to place and is like the first arrival? Like, I cannot stop thinking about this. And
do you want to know the story behind Lester Uff? There's an actual...
I must know.
So back in when we were all going through lockdown, and there was a point in lockdown where I was having to isolate from my partner, living in the same flat, but I was having to isolate because I had COVID at the time. He didn't, so we were in separate rooms. And, you know, he would make my food and bring it to me on a tray and all very kind of Victorian, struggling in a, you know, room, waif-like, all of that. And there was one time where he slipped a little note under the door, and I thought, oh, that's so sweet. A love note. Oh, it's going to be so precious. And oh, isn't that lovely? I went and I opened it, and it was a torn bit. It was a torn off bit from an egg carton that just said Lester Eggs. And I was looking at it and I was like, okay. And then he just texted me going, this would be my wrestling name. And I was like, okay. And now almost every game I've worked on, I have fitted in some way Lester Eggs or Lester Uff, as I decided to make it a little bit more obscure. But that is my, so there is a, there's a,
this is like your Acme Corporation.
It really is.
That's really smart though, because it means your partner can now never become a professional wrestler, because he'll violate copyright.
He will be
if he does.
Infringing IP. Prior art. Yeah, exactly.
You see what I've done there, John? I've taken that power dynamic and I've changed it. to be in my favour. And truly, isn't that what relationships are all about?
It's all about subtle methods of control. Yes, Holly, mm-hmm, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, of subtle methods of control.
No, but I think, I mean, it speaks to writing, doesn't it? That we're all looking for our subtle methods of control. So I think the last thing I wanted to ask really was just one more question about this idea of the cited sources and the kind of the sources and the unreliability and the kind of the framing. You mentioned in Dragon Age, they use that explicitly to kind of offset the story. And I wondered about how that plays into player assumptions, because that's often a challenge we have, is that players enter a game with a really clear assumption of what kind of thing they're playing and how it's going to work. And then if you try to challenge that, as I have experienced in my career, the people find that a little bit surprising, and sometimes they just sort of, they can't connect with what you're doing. That, do you think that the sort of cited examples, do you think they can work in those larger, I'm thinking particularly of the larger, bigger, more expensive games where the narrative content is more of a sidebar? Mm-hmm. Are we asking too much of players if we want to start treating those sources as cited, conflicting, argumentative points, or are those games crying out for that kind of description? Like, if you walked into a big AAA, if you were suddenly teleported into the God of War studio or someone like that, would you be saying, like, number one thing we need to do with our lore drops is we need to add this? Or would you be saying, yeah, it's a step too far in this context?
I mean, I personally would be, because I think...
Fair enough.
Yeah, okay. I personally would be, because I think it's one of those things, because if a player does just want to take this at face value, they can. if they want to just read it and go, okay, yeah, that's that, they can absolutely do that.
It's still fun.
Yeah. And, you know, also, I think just from a... From a player perspective, it changes tone and voice a lot, which is way more fun to read. It's way more fun if you have a bunch of different tones and voices, and this person writes this way, this person writes that way. It's just it adds a variety that's more interesting, even if you don't want to do that deeper dive in it, that deeper level. And I think actually Dragon Age I can't speak, never worked in a Dragon Age game, but I remember there was a kind of a thing that happened in Dragon Age Inquisition when it came out, in that there was a kind of big story reveal that contradicted what had previously been told. And in their games, in the codexes, they're all cited, you know, everything's, it's from, you know, this writer or that writer, this whatever. And so, yeah, they have that thing where actually, you know, they can say, well, actually, you know, this is... Right. This interpretation was wrong. And actually, and some players really didn't like that, because I think we live in a world of kind of fan-made wikis and canon and lore, and everything has to be figured out. And this, you know, that thing happens there and all of this stuff. And that can be sometimes really wonderful. That can be a great community thing, like you said, of the Doctor Who thing and people figuring stuff out and putting stuff together. But it can also, because it's video games, become quite toxic quite quickly of people being very angry. And I actually made it was just like a short interactive fiction for a academic panel I was doing about history and games, and it's called You're Ruining My Lore. And the idea, it's like the short little interactive fiction about there's this big MMO that's been going on for ages, and a bit of information comes out in a new update that contradicts something, and it's players in a kind of, you know, blog post talking about it and going, okay, well, in this they said that, and they said, oh, well, this writer left, and it's this idea of you know, and after that writer left, it all went to hell. It was like, oh, well, actually, I disagree because this, you know, and talking about, and actually this kind of, this very meta level of like unpacking and seeing, like, okay, what's a really reliable source, if this,
yes, what's the true art there,
what's, yeah, and all of this, and that's an aspect of storytelling I personally really don't like. That's the kind of thing that I'm like, oh god, this really puts me
off. It's really interesting to put that in the context of the Doctor Who example as well, he says boringly, because a lot of the fans will say, oh, well, this particular Doctor Who writer, we don't agree with anything that he put in the lore. So we'd like to do the version with him subtracted, and you end up with this weird sort of, where is the true Doctor Who if you're all editing your sources on the fly anyway?
And it's kind of interesting because they've accidentally fallen into being historians.
They've fallen into being,
you know, this version I think works really well because of this, and actually this version. And so actually it's really interesting to watch, and I find it fascinating to watch, because they've fallen into being, you know, doing the historical process from a different angle.
You're absolutely right. And they are citing their sources. They're literally doing what you said, because they're saying... This Doctor Who is the one written by Stephen Moffat, and that is the citation. Oh God, that's genius.
And they'll be going,
and even more than that.
Yeah,
even
be going, more than that. In this interview, he said this. Well, in that interview on that day, in this timeline, you know. And so they're falling into being historians. And so I kind of think, well, why not like take that and put it in the game? They're gonna do it anyway. They are going to do this. They're gonna find. Yeah. And I think I always find Dark Souls a really interesting example, because if I bring up anything to do with history and world building and all that, people go, "Did you know in Dark Souls the lore is told through the through the items?" And I go, "Actually, yes, I did." Yes. You know, and it's just it was a constant battle in my life. But one thing I find really interesting, and I've kind of joked about this, but now I really want them to do it, is I'm like, well, who's writing the descriptions in a Dark Souls game? I really want them to reveal, because in Dark Souls 2, you come across a character who's building ladders, who's the character that is making the ladders in the game. And I want them to do that. I want it to be just a weird little goblin that is writing. It turns out they were the one writing these item descriptions. Yeah. And because that's the thing that I find interesting with that is, okay, it's trying to use material culture, but translating material culture into the written word, because you can't expect a player to be able to look at a thing and understand that, okay, well, that symbol is from that. It requires a layer of knowledge and being able to look at stuff that just isn't available. And so I think the tension there actually lies in translating material culture as a source into something else. But people get a huge amount of joy of trying to figure out these, you know, whole communities, whole, you know, endless hours of essays and all of this. And so I think people actually love being historians. They love playing at historians. And so why not embrace that and make it part of your game, even if it's not explicit, even if it's not, well, that's not what the game's about. It gives that something, and I think, yeah, it gives that plausible deniability, which is always nice, particularly on a bigger game. But it gives that extra level for people who want it, and people who don't want it, they don't have to engage with it.
I love that. What a passionate defense of the of the concept of ambiguity, and I think that's a fantastic thing for us to embrace. Right, we could, as I think is becoming a theme with all of our interviews, we could carry on doing this for hours and hours, but we should probably stop at some point. So I'd just like to say thank you very much, Holly. It's been absolutely brilliant having you on.
Oh, thank you so much. My pleasure.